Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Art of Tracking Radio Show. Tracking is still alive and well. Join us as we interview master trackers from around the world. We'll hear their stories, their secrets. So tune in and enjoy all you hear. Welcome.
Hello, I'm Willem Larson, your host for this episode, and today we are continuing an ongoing conversation with Kevin Behan, author of Natural Dog Training and Your Dog is Your Mirror, and developer of the Immediate Moment Theory, the theory that animal minds and bodies move in accord with what they are experiencing in the immediate moment, without human-like intentions or thoughts of the future or past. This is our third conversation with Kevin as we continue to explore the implications of modeling animal behavior through the immediate moment. Our first conversation covered the idea that there is but one emotion and that it is a force of attraction that flows through all animals. Our second conversation focused on the two-brain makeup of animals, having the big brain in the head that wants things to stay away and stay the same, versus the small brain in the gut that wants essentially the opposite, ingestion and movement. Now in this third episode, we'll be talking about the emotional battery and the physical embodied memory that informs the behavior of animals that cannot leave the immediate moment. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Well, it's very good to be here.
Fantastic. So we talked a little before about if you have this flow of energy through a system, and if it just runs to ground, there's nothing to charge up the system again. And so, and that brought us into this idea of the emotional battery, that it's a that requirement. And I'm wondering if you could just start there and tell us what is the role of the emotional battery, and what is it exactly?
Right. Well, it's a more complex iteration of the principle of conductivity. So we have these two brains in conflict that create a constitutional state of tension from which there is a release when a pure attractor is perceived by the organism. But in the pursuit of that attractor, inevitably the animal, the organism encounters resistance. Unless someone is going to hook you up IV to sugar water, there's resistance to overcome. You have to do work to get sustenance, to obtain nutrient. And so in the course of moving toward what you're attracted to, the organism experiences resistance, and this is stress or unresolved emotion, and it builds up in the body-mind as an emotional battery, so that every physical act of movement creates a record in the body. And this is the fundamental metric of experience for the animal. And anyhow, that charge, the difference between stress and emotion is, the most important difference is, it can build up, it accumulates. So the more you move around, the more you do things, the more stress is acquired, the more unresolved emotion is acquired, and this builds up and up and up, until finally, if the organism doesn't take necessary actions, it'll have an overload, and then it'll need to purge that. It's sort of like it's like any battery. If you overload it, overcharge it, then it's got to find an immediate discharge. And this is where people would have a problem with an immediate moment, a surface reading of an immediate moment, because obviously animals have memory, and memory informs them. So the immediate moment doesn't discount that, but what it says is the physical memories are relived as if they are happening in the moment. And the animal doesn't distinguish between a physical memory and a present reality. In fact, you can go so far as to say that the animal never experiences the moment directly. Physical memories are triggered in the situation by the intensity of the resistance the animal in that moment is experiencing. This activates physical memories, and that determines the animals. We might as well just switch it to dogs to make it more NDT-like.
Yeah.
But then the dog experiences the moment in terms of the past. Mm. So his memory is always being summoned up to the surface. It's what I'm saying is that it's not an act of volition. It's not a feat of remembering. Mm. It's the memory being triggered and the animal reliving it as if it's happening all over again. And this is very consistent with the modern emphasis on PTSD. Mm. And it's been something I've been concentrating on since the late 70s. So, I really think the immediate moment presages a lot of the current neurology and the modern emphasis on the emotional impact of experience. So the physical memories are always being triggered. And the next thing to say, I'm jumping a little bit far ahead, but just mm-hmm. to put it into context, that experiencing all the physical memories as a one lump sum value, I call it the quantitative versus qualitative, and I liken it to the net worth of an entrepreneur. Their total net worth is a lump sum value that then can have consequences in the moment and make new energy, a new reality. So the physical memory doesn't trap the animal in the past. It can also serve as a lump sum value as an emotional counterweight to whatever the dog is attracted to, especially if it's making a lot of resistance. So it is not a limiting mandate that this physical memory comes up to the surface, because under certain conditions, that physical memory can serve as one contiguous whole, and then it serves as a counterbalance to whatever the dog is attracted to. And that's when we have social energy in a new cooperative configuration. And unfortunately, that's been ascribed to the intention states and to deductive reasoning in a human linear thought process to account for the incredible intelligence that this phenomenon manifests and makes possible. So the way I'm using the term physical memory, it can encode for new cooperative configurations that spontaneously emerge in the moment, even though they're summoned up from the past. So it'd be like two entrepreneurs getting together and they have a certain amount of money at their disposal. And they can interface, and all right, I'll put up half of my net worth, and you put up an equal amount, whatever percentage of your net worth is, and now we have a 50-50 partnership, and we create a new business. Hmm. So it's how you make new energy from old energy, and it's a much simpler explanation or much more parsimonious explanation for complex, cooperative, intelligent, adaptive behavior than trying to find human intellectual processes going on.
So are you really saying that stress and trauma are a resource?
Exactly.
Because we usually think of them as like negative things. I'm stressed out or the trauma is holding me back. But you're saying somehow that those are actually stored value that can be used for work.
Right. And, you know, there's some colloquial recognition of this in the colloquial use of language. We'll say that somebody has gravitas, mm-hmm. and they've just had a lot of life experiences. And mostly we mean, you know, some pretty tough experiences which gave them a certain presence. And the Quakers say a good friend has weight to them. Mm-hmm. And they use the term weighty to describe friendships. And or words have weight. It's not meaning that you're the most positive person. It means you've seen a lot of stress. You've had stress. You've recorded stress in your experiences. And it gives you a refined perspective on stuff. So, yeah, stress is very important. I like to say it this way. It's the only way nature can transmit information of an emotional content through time and without error. If there's no other way to do it, it flawlessly replicates itself. But it's up to the leveraging that memory in the moment to turn it into new energy. And you know, that's our challenge as conscious beings, is to participate in that reconversion of stress into flow, back into flow. But now it'll be a more complex expression of it. It can't be the same simple replication. It's got to be more complex, so it brings in more entities into that flow pattern. And that's why what we're seeing in these collectivized behaviors of vast swarms of birds and schooling of fish, it's the stress that allows them to do that, not a simple form of attraction.
So what, you know, you say that we're projecting cognitive memory on dogs and other animals, and so I'm wondering, could you provide an example of in a human being, when do we have experiences of physical memory, and when do we have experiences of cognitive memory? Like, basically, what's the difference, and how do we experience them?
Yeah, the easiest way I think I can explain the difference is I live a little bit inland, or quite a bit inland, and I could be standing out in my yard talking with somebody about summer vacation on the beach and going to Long Island Shore to Cape Cod, and he, you know, that person and I, we can really get going thinking about pleasant experiences we've had at the beaches, and we're having a good experience remembering those events, and that's a mental process. But on occasion, sometimes the briny breeze will reach its way this far inland, and you'll smell that salt-laden, moist air, and your whole body releases when you smell that, and you just feel like you're at the beach. You're actually reliving what it felt like to be at the beach, as opposed to remembering. And again, that points us back to the PTSD research, is where the victim is reliving the memory. He's not remembering it. He's in it and going through it all over again. And so that's the difference between physical memory as a vivid recapitulation of it. Another way of understanding it in that vein is children, for example, don't make a delineation between real powerful imagination and reality. Or like if we wake up from a dream that's super vivid, it takes us a while to realize it wasn't real. So physical memories are like that. They are completely real. And for the animal mind, that is always, the moment is always triggering physical memories, they don't make a distinction between what they're feeling in their body. Whatever they feel in their body, they superimpose onto the moment, into the situation. It's like if you bring a dog into the house, if the dog grew up in a house where the door always opens to one side, it takes them a long time. You know, some dogs, there's some odd doors that open in instead of out, and a dog will come up to me onto our farm here, and they're used to that kind of door, and it takes them a long time. Every time I open the door, he's expecting it to go in the other direction. Not expecting it, but experiencing it as going in the other direction. And it's not a simple thing. Now, we do that as well, that ingrained memory.
Right.
We're always competing with that. But our minds are so active, we can glide right over it, or we kind of laugh at it. We don't really give it the weight that it deserves. A story came to my mind the other day. I was telling someone, I used to have a little papillon. And a couple times a year, I would take all my dogs and leave them at my boarding kennel while we went on vacation, where we might fly somewhere and the dogs couldn't come. Only a couple times a year, this little papillon would go up to the kennel, and then after we'd come home, I'd go to work, and I'd bring all the dogs. I have two big shepherds and this little Papillon. And they'd mass at the gate that led to the walk to the front door, and the kids are inside. They're waiting to see the doggies. And I open the garden, the door to the walkway, the gate, and they run down there. And the little Papillon doesn't want to get trampled by the shepherd, so he would always make a beeline to the left, go under the hedges, and run to the front door. He'd meet the shepherds at the front door and wouldn't get trampled underneath. He'd bypass the path.
Uh-huh.
And one summer, we built a little tiny patio off to the left of that walkway. It only went up one brick riser off the ground. It was very inconsequential, but little Papillon has to jump up because it was it was like a wall to him, a retaining wall to him. And all summer, all spring and summer and fall, he played with my kids, running up and down, jumping on and off that patio brick riser. And then we went away, and I brought them back, just like I always do, and they're at the garden gate waiting for me to open the gate so they can run down to the house. I open the door, the gate, and all three dogs bolt down the walkway, and the Papillon makes a left to go to bypass that. And I hear a thud and a groan. He had run chest first into that brick riser. And he had jumped on and off that thing thousands of times for month after month after month. But the physical memory, that specific degree of intensity of being away from the house for a period of time, being with the other two dogs who are all excited at the garden gate, that memory was recapitulated. And he hadn't experienced it maybe in a year, in 10 months, a year, a long time. But that memory took over, and he had no idea there was a brick riser there. And he ran right into it chest first. So that's how powerful physical memory is on the animal mind. And I'm also well aware of it through the police dog training. When you start training a police dog, you're always running away from the young candidate dog. He's always chasing the prey. And then when he gets more experienced, then we got to teach him to take the criminal head on. We face the dog, but we backpedal. And we're threatening him while running backwards, and then the dog's released, and he runs into the helper and bites the sleeve, etc. And so for the rest of his life, after we create that imprint, even when somebody, eventually you run right at the dog at full speed, and you have to be a little skilled to catch him correctly so you can absorb the shock, he never slows down. No matter what the criminal's doing, he always feels as if the criminal's running away. So he gets conditioned to hit with this high impact that never lessens, because the dog's drive, the release of this stress is so powerful, and the physical memory has been skillfully implanted in a police dog's mind so that he always feels the criminal's running away, even when the criminal's running right at him, shooting a gun at him and brandishing a club. That's how powerful physical memory is. And that's why he hits as if the prey is retreating. He puts that much force into it because that's his feeling for how he gets to make contact. So the immediate moment, paradoxically, always involves the physical memory of the past. But it's not a conscious cognitive remembering in the animal mind. It's a vivid reliving. As vivid as when you have a dream that's just so powerful when you wake up, you're usually grateful at what didn't really happen. But it took you a while to come to reality it didn't happen.
So you've mentioned before that you can release stress, but you can also resolve it. What's the difference between releasing physical memory and resolving it?
Yeah, it can be triggered and released in a load-overload manner. And then when you get through this purging, it's a state of enervation where you feel weak and exhausted and not empowered. But you have relief. And then the animal gets addicted to that surge of violent outpouring of energy that led to a state of relief. And they're two totally different mind states. So that the dog, after he gets this purging, is not aware of what he had done when he was berserk with this hectic energy that, in most cases, he bites something. He has no idea he just did that damage to whatever it was he overloaded on. Mm-hmm. So the distinction is the load overload is a short-term relief that becomes addictive, because if the dog doesn't have the proper experiences, tutelage, that becomes his definition of happiness. Mm-hmm. And the way I like to explain it to my clients, it's like someone in an abusive relationship is always getting traumatized, but then there's that makeup relief when their partner, you know, has a moment of, sorry, I didn't mean to be like that, abusive like that. And that relief is that person's, that victimized person's definition of love. And they get addicted to it. And that's why you can't talk someone out of that situation, because that's their definition of love. It's all they know. And likewise, any organism that's on this load-overload footing, they get addicted to that. Even if you're on the receiving end of it, you can get addicted to that surge of adrenaline and the exploding venting of energy. That becomes the animal's, the organism's definition of movement. And whereas if that outpouring of energy leads to syncopated, complex, coordinated movements with others, that's resolving. That is a true state of happiness. And it's, this is where we go back to physical memory in a quantitative sense as emotional ballast. So if you project your physical memories into another and they into you, and then you achieve syncopation, I call that emotional weightlessness. And that is, another word for that is joy. And that's the basis, in my view, of altruism and cooperation and complex social behavior, is if your stress is triggered and it can be conducted and channeled into syncopated group action, that is resolving. And that is the true definition of happiness. And that's also why altruism is built into our makeup and cooperation is built into our makeup, because we can't, one can't feel good unless the other feels good. One example I think I've given already is if you go on vacation with a bunch of friends and somebody falls ill, I mean, you kind of want to stay around them, and or if they're depressed, some crisis comes up for them. It's hard, if they're a good friend, it's hard to go out and continue with your vacation plans if someone's suffering. So you try to, you want to stay close and help them through it. And someone is designated to be the support person, and then you'll make the best of the vacation as you can, but it's not going to feel right if everybody's having fun but the one person is not having fun. That's not right. So we have that built into our nature. If you walk into a room and someone is obviously sullen, withdrawn, depressed, you want to do something to help them out of that, because we have this group mind mentality where we project our physical memories into others. And what reflects back to us, we want to bring, you know, return it as a positive emotional affect to ourselves, and it makes us social by nature. That's what's really motivating. It's this interplay between emotion and stress, and we can only resolve it by aligning and synchronizing with that which triggers it. That makes us social by nature. And it's not a high-level cognitive thing. It's very low-level body-mind as an emotional dynamo, the pipe, the battery, the dynamo that makes us social beings. And currently, it's pretty much all being attributed to the higher cognitive processes. But there's inklings, there's work, you know, there's definitely trending towards looking deeper. And that's why physicists are having a lot to say about collectivized behavior, and they're looking for basic systems rules, and they're finding them.
Right.
And this is evidence that it's not high level mental acuity, that it's a much more primal process. And so this interplay between emotion, stress, and resolved stress, or resolved unresolved emotion, turning physical memories of resistance back into flow. This is the basic operating system of the animal mind, and therefore of a networked intelligence in general. Hmm. That this network comes first. Information is always network coherent, and it's axiomatic that it'll produce a network. It's not the individual animals and species aren't out there competing against each other, and information is somehow coming out of that gene play. It's already embedded in the makeup of the organisms. That's my reading of nature and the nature of animal behavior. It's the only thing I think makes sense when we can see the common way that all animals interact according to this network protocols of emotion becoming unresolved emotion when the organism meets with resistance, and then through collectivized behavior, unresolved emotion becomes resolved. For example, I think that's what's going on in the starling murmurations, when for no real biological reason, 500,000 birds will combine and just form these amazing vortexes and energy patterns. I believe they are resolving unresolved emotion and creating a collectivized. And on one level, biologically, in the typical neo-Darwinian way of looking at things, there really is no adaptive purpose to that. But in my way of looking at it, it just reflects the necessity of these organisms to collectivize. And it just speaks to the way the whole network is organized. So it's adaptive because it's the way the network functions. Hmm. And they're tuning their capacity to be in harmony with the way nature itself is. So, of course, in that level, it's very adaptive.
So, Ken, you mentioned release as large, violent, electric displays of behavior.
Right.
But can they be more subtle, more smaller, more, you know, like being attracted to and grounding in a smell, or is that resolving?
I would call that release.
Okay.
Yeah, I like to make a distinction between these two brains are in conflict, mm-hmm. and then there's a pure prayful essence, a pure emotional attractor or ground, mm-hmm. and when the organism smells something of the body and something very earthy, that is a release from that tension.
Okay.
Whereas relief is you build up this resistance from getting these releasers, and now you may not have the emotional capacity to align and synchronize with the things that are sources of resistance. And therefore, you build up this charge and you hit an overload, and then you have this electrical discharge-like pattern of behavior, and those are release. That's the distinction I make between a release and relief.
Oh, okay.
So the relief is the load overload. It's a short term, yeah. And it's a short term feeling of relief, like vomiting would be. You eat bad food and you throw up, you do feel better, but it's not exactly healthy to do it on a repetitive basis. And yet we see there's a human condition that gets addicted to it, the anorexia.
Yeah. So just to make sure, I want you to maybe repeat that, because those words are very close. So the resolving is a whole, setting that aside, you're saying there's release and there's relief. Is that right?
And resolving, right.
Okay.
Right.
And so in relief, release is the load overload. Is that right?
Yeah, that's more complex than release.
And relief is?
Release would be the simple body-mind type. And so two dogs see each other. Well, that's still complex. We won't go there. But a dog is walking along, and there's something dead on the side of the road, and he rolls in it.
Yeah.
That's a pure release. There's no there's very little resistance between him connecting with that ground.
Yeah.
So that's a pure release. Whereas relief would be he sees another dog, and the dog stiffens up, and he stiffens up, and then they have a little kerfuffle, and let's just say it didn't come to any big violence, but a little tuft of hair flew, possibly. But if he did it to the wrong dog, you'd get a real big fight, but that would be relief from his tension.
So relief is the electric and usually involves some resistance, whereas release is sort of without resistance, like that dog, or like a kid sucking their thumb or getting a massage, or is that right?
Say that again.
Well, so I just want to make sure that these terms, which are so close, I'm understanding them right. So you have behaviors like a dog rolling in something stinky, or a child sucking their thumb, or getting a massage. Right, those all seem to have something in common, where being the guy who like gets into a bar fight or arguments or drives crazy and then feels better, like that seems to be like another class of behaviors. Is that right?
Right, I would agree with that. Yes.
And so right.
You have release in the first category.
Okay.
Which is it's a pure soothing of the body mind.
Okay.
So here's this person touching you, but you're not even responding to them as if they're a person. It's just the pure pleasure conduit, and you're just melting into the moment. It's not like there's two people relating to each other. It's a pure emotional ground. Yeah, I would call that release, right? Relief would be dumping onboard stress.
Okay.
You've built up this stress repository, and you got to download. And then, what's interesting is, even stress functions as a force of attraction, but it's attracted to the negative, the predatory aspect. So the guy goes to the bar, and he's this frustrated macho thing going on, and he goes to the bar, and he's looking for a fight. And he picks out somebody that he looks for the negative that he can get relief against.
Okay.
And then he gets into this fight, but it's not satisfying. There's a part of him that feels more incomplete now than before, because whenever you do release, overload, you end up with more charge than what you started.
Oh, wow.
You may recall years ago they identified the type A personality, anger, I guess it was, and it was said to get anger out of your system and, you know, express your anger. But they follow-up study a decade or so later found out that type A's that vented their anger got angrier. They got angrier and angrier. They never got, it didn't make them feel better, it made them feel worse. They built up more and more of a charge. So the problem with that load overload is you get addicted to the overload, but you're not processing that energy toward resolution. And so you just build up more charge, because whatever resistance, you're going to meet with resistance. You beat the heck out of some poor guy, and everybody else in the bar says, you're a punk. All right, you're tough, but you're a jerk. Get out of here. So you end up more angry. Resolving unresolved stress doesn't go through the load overload. It goes what I alluded to as a dynamo, where it'd be like two entrepreneurs say, okay, I got $50,000 to invest. You put in 25, and I get two thirds. You get one third, and that's how they can become perfect counterbalances. And I say quantitative versus qualitative because it doesn't matter how you made the money, presuming it to be legally made. But it doesn't matter if somebody made it as a hairdresser, or somebody made it as a stockbroker. It's just quantitatively has a net worth lump sum value. So in the dynamo, the higher level, you have the pipe begets the battery, but the battery begets the dynamo. And the dynamo is your physical memory as a lump sum gravitas. You then put it out there and someone becomes the counterbalance to it. And with that counterbalance, you achieve weightlessness, which is resolution of that stress. One way I can think of explaining it is how powerful it is you could go to a movie about some historical figure of whom you really don't like. You've built up antipathy toward that person from everything you've read about them or know about them. But this movie happens to be a compelling, sympathetic portrait with the right music, lighting, and during the course of the movie, you project into that historical figure, and now you achieve weightlessness with that person.
Hmm.
And your whole lifetime, the qualitative physical memories you have toward that person can shift in an instant, and now you see it from their point of view.
Hmm.
And all that built-up charge you might have to that person, every time you'd hear of that figure, you're like, there's a part of you that bristles,
yeah,
and you don't like that person. You rise to beat down the person that likes them, and you'll get into arguments about that historical figure. But after you see this movie, you just sat there, but you experienced through emotional projection, you went into a state of suspension, and you entered this surreal landscape where time was completely fluid according to the narrative of the story, the movie. And years went by in moments, according to the script, and you totally suspended your whole life history about that person and came out of that movie with a different viewpoint.
Hmm.
You totally resolved all that stuff. Hopefully it was an accurate sympathetic portrait, but with the right music, acting, slanting of details, you can change someone's view of someone in moments. They become in counterbalance with that figure. And then you get the resolution of that charge that you always had toward that person. And, you know, we have this, we've all experienced it interpersonally with relationships where you finally understand what that other person was going through that you had antipathy toward, and now you can achieve counterbalance with them. That is resolution.
Mm.
And that comes out of the dynamo. And one way I can explain the dynamo is if we have this emotional battery where resistance builds up and up, and if we just arbitrarily overpower resistance every time we meet with it, we just build up more and more of a charge. Well, let's just say we have a 200-volt battery in our system and our counterpart has a 200-volt battery as well. They're the same species as our fellow human. Well, we don't have a 200-volt problem. Because we project our physical center of gravity into them and they into us, we have a 400-volt problem.
Hmm.
Their problem is my problem. If I just overpower them, I get all their resistance in me. And now I have 400 volts. I feel worried, like the guy going to the bar.
Yeah.
He feels more and more ostracized. Actually, Mike Tyson is a good example of that.
Yeah.
You know, he was the bad boy of boxing, and he just kept getting more and more and more of that charge and felt more and more ostracized. And then he had to go through all these life crises, and it seems now that he's come out on the other side and kind of achieved resolution with all that stuff. He seems to be have had accomplished that from what one can see from this distance. But so we don't have a 200-volt problem. We have a 400-volt problem. Anything we're attracted to, if they push back more against us, we got all that to account for. So that's why I mentioned with the vacation scenario, I can't feel good unless you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes two to resolve unresolved emotion.
So
that's, again, another way of saying we're social by nature.
Yeah, so for example, if I'm having work problems, maybe with someone at work, and I get to this, I accumulate this stress, and I get to this fork in the road where on the left is release with maybe massages or vacation, and in the middle is venting to friends or getting into fights where I just, you know, make it worse. I increase the charge, even though I get relief. And then on the right is actually projecting into that person and seeing things from their point of view and somehow managing to couple with them and counterbalance them. And that's where the system grows. That's where the actual capacity of the system expands from. Is that
exactly?
And release and relief, it seems like, and then it's kind of like entropy, where it's just all this valuable stress is just released into the stratosphere, into space.
Yeah, and well, that brings us back to the beauty of thermodynamics is nature has all the time in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it looks like it's lost to entropy, but you put your heat onto something else, and it acquired the heat. And sooner or later, someone's going to turn that into resolved energy, into more complex flow. And that returns us to thermodynamics. It can't, the system, the network is in place so that energy cannot be lost. Information cannot be lost. It's always going to stay in the system. So if someone goes out on a shooting spree, yeah, the system will not entropy. It will respond to it and become more collectivized. Hmm. And it always is the way. It's going to keep, that stress is going to register. And so entropy will be, stress, which is caused from entropy, is part of the making the configuration more and more complex. So it's actually how the organism stays recharged and keeps recharging the system. Now, if we just get locked into the addictive cycle of load overload, well, it won't accrue to our personal advantage. We will get burned up, used up, and cast aside by the system. But that's a choice that hopefully we can become aware of and choose not to go that route. And as you say, choose door number three, where if you play ping pong with it, project into them, they project into you, and if you can play that process of elaboration back and forth until both parties can feel a flow going on in this, which is exactly what we're seeing when two dogs that are afraid of each other, they're tentative, they're not hardened fighters yet, they'll start going back and forth, and you can see them visibly soften until they can feel the flow in aligning and synchronizing with each other. Their whole biology, their whole physiology, why they lift their legs, why they do everything, is predicated on helping them achieve that. It's built into their every aspect of their makeup and their being and the way their mind processes information. Nature does not leave it out to the individual to figure out on their own. It does not do it. I don't believe that makes any sense. It's like the economy does not leave it up to us to figure out what money is worth.
Right.
The economy, the whole network is out there.
Well, that kind of begs the question, though, like, how does a dog or other animal, how do they choose to go down a release or a relief or a resolving path to, move that stress? Like, how does that happen?
If they have enough time and space, they always will. Hmm. It's immutable. Mm-hmm. If they have enough time and space, and let's speak about dogs in our domestic context, we take them out of having enough time and space by, we confine them and we speed things up. We just throw people visit with their dogs now. They take dogs to friends' houses. I mean, that's not normal. And years ago, when I started in the dog business, nobody took their dog to another dog's house. It was considered bad form, unless you had to. Mm-hmm. It's like, why would I bring my dog into your dog's space? That's his home, and he's going to feel... But people thought like that in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Huh. But now it's thought that dogs are like children, and you take them every house, and they should be welcomed by the dog that's already there. How we've shifted. If we took two killer dogs, two dogs out of the pits, they're ready to fight to the death in some Okie-Kanokie underground illegal fight scene, and we turn them loose in a big enough area, they will not fight. Being in nature, their sensitivity to pressure will become heightened, and they'll be approaching each other, and they'll feel pressure. They'll start this pipe, two brain differential bipolar makeup. The two brains won't be in accord, so they'll do these circuitous behaviors, like lifting the leg out of unsureness, and the other dog will investigate the urine. Little by little, they'll draw together. Hmm. If they don't have a group of dogs already around them, then they'll need each other. Hmm. And immutably, they will connect. I think we could take any two dogs, put them on an island, and they'll get along. Hmm. And, we see this, actually. We see this in Europe, where there are free-range dog communities. Some of the cities... Dogs can, and matter of fact, out in Colorado is very much that way. It's a lot of these ski resort places. Dogs are free range, running all over the place. And they have very little behavioral problems because there's enough time and space. If a dog's having a bad experience, he can withdraw enough, and reintegrate as he feels safe, and they always will. So that when we compress them into our situation is when we see all these so-called troubles, all this dysfunction. But I was able in my work to see that even there's a functionality even to the dysfunction, that it wasn't the intention to maul, hurt, territory, claim territory. That was the imposition of a human thought pattern onto it. There was a deeper thing going on. It was all a function of attraction. And so anyhow, that's how the immediate moment led me to understand the physical memory, stress as a physical memory, as being a more complex operating dynamic. So it begets the social behavior, because my problem becomes your problem. I can't be happy unless you are happy, and vice versa. And so sometimes when I speak in these terms, I know I mentioned that earlier, that people think I'm speaking mechanistically, but it's really much more sublime than that. It's built in, the nature of sociability is built into the organism. It's not something they figure out on their own. And that's really my mission, is to try to make that as vivid as I can, so people can start to see it when they see dogs interact. But we're going against a real strong tide, because the people who are recognizing, you know, the experts who are recognizing the amazing intelligence of animals, at the same token, they gotta translate it into human thought-like processes. So that's the argument I get into them, is for them not to accord a human thought to the dog is, in their minds, it's like saying the dog isn't intelligent. The only way they can understand intelligence is a function of human thinking. And terms like survival and territoriality, dominance and submission, those are human thoughts.
Tracking books are full of references to territoriality, or, you know, this mark means this kind of intention against males of this species, you know, and and that's why I'm so excited about this, because it never felt quite right, and it feels like something else is going on. Well, and speaking of intelligence, so would you say that, you mentioned the concept of emotional capacity before, which is that seems like intelligence then in this context, you know, is it not as like it allows you to choose between release, relief, and resolving, to choose like what is really going to be the best use of the stress that's in the system, because you have room. Is that a good way of thinking about it, or?
Oh, could you restate that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead and explain to us what is emotional capacity, and how does that connect to this an animal's decision to resolve stress or release stress, or to seek the load unload of relief? Like, are those connected concepts, and how are they?
Okay. Yeah. Well, in any interaction, all these three levels come into play. The the body mind is a pipe, pure emotion going through it.
Yeah.
Then the body mind is a battery where it stores stress, and stress is held back. It doesn't come out through pure flow like emotion does. It comes out in more complex situations. So when the animal meets with resistance, he needs a memory of what worked in the past, and what have I experienced in the past. So if the intensity of the resistance is too much, then his physical memory will serve as a barrier, a block, and he'll defer from pursuing that straight path, straight ahead path. Now, so there's, you can kind of see it when dogs, you can very much see it with problem dogs, I should say, is they get together, they come together, you can see they're both tense, and they start smelling each other. And things are going good. You see their tails wag a little bit. Now, if you don't carefully manage what then follows, The next thing that happens is it's like a valve opens. And all of a sudden, there's a growl, there's a snark, and there's a bomb, there's an explosion. Hmm. And in my view, that is indicative of stress coming online. Mm-hmm. So the two dogs met each other, and they smell each other's privates or their saliva. And it might be head-to-head. And they get a little prey grounding, and that's like opening a valve.
Okay.
And now stress has access into it adds to the stream of consciousness, if you will.
Yeah.
It adds to the pipe. And that brings us to the notion of emotional capacity. Hmm. When the intensity of the situation gets too much, then instincts take over. And I would add thoughts with humans. But instincts take over, and then you get the load-overload pattern. Whereas if the capacity is high and stress is then added to the currents, it is possible for that to be a sensual, sexual kind of energy. Mm-hmm. And that's with high emotional capacity. Mm-hmm. And then, now, the animal has a means of aligning and synchronizing with the object of resistance instead of overloading and acting instinctively. And the hallmark of this more refined, high emotional capacity is it will mirror, become the equal opposite in every way of what it's attracted to. Hmm. So if the other animal is tentative and stiff, it will visibly get circuitous and soften. If the dog just stands there motionless, it may sit. It may even lay down. It may even start to belly rub or flip over on its back in front of it. And it'll become the equal opposite of it because it's feeling the potential of flow. So it's now responding to that object of resistance to the most rudimentary of systems. It's as if it's walking along, it's traveling over open ground, and comes to a ditch. Mm-hmm. That's wide enough, it's not too wide to jump over. So what does it do? It gathers, it collects itself onto its hind end, and then it launches itself and resumes its travels. So when a dog with high emotional capacity meets with an object of resistance, it doesn't see it as an interruption. It's like coming to that ditch. Well, all right, I just got to collect my energy and absorb my energy before I can go forward again. Mm-hmm. It doesn't see collecting the recoil as a roadblock, as a setback, as going in the wrong direction. It sees that I'm going back for a couple strides to get a running start to get over the hurdle. So if we watch two dogs get together, if one has a high emotional capacity, the other one not, the one with a high capacity will collect itself and will go backwards. It'll look away. It'll put its weight into its hind end, just as if it's come to a blowdown on a trail, a ditch in a field, something it can get across because all it can feel is the potential for flow. Hmm. It can feel the release at the very bottom, the releaser at the very bottom of its body-mind. You're basically recapitulating the body-mind as a pipe, but now it incorporates two individuals as part of that simple rudimentary pipe. So even though stress comes online and it's coming into the body-mind of this high-capacity dog, he's actually now treating stress as if it's pure emotion once again. Just like he's a simple little puppy, full of pure emotion, and he's not knocked off balance by the resistance he's getting from his soon-to-be playmate, but who's not quite there yet. And so now from the other dog's point of view, he sees this dog acting prey-like. He sees this dog absorbing his momentum, his energy, and becoming soft and circuitous and belly up. That's acting prey-like. So that satisfies his body-mind pipe. All of a sudden, he feels safe enough to venture a snook and smell the dog's genitals, and now he's getting essence of the body, urine and musk scent. And now his body-mind is feeling whole, and he can put his weight on his hind end he shifts his orientation to his hind end, and now you got the enteric nervous system running both dogs, and that's the social brain. And when they turn into the dynamo, where they can get really intense with each other, but they just get more sensual and softer, that's when I believe the heart takes over. And now they're doing a network functionality where they're going to become so emotionally entrained that they're going to go out, they got the 400-volt problem, and they're going to go out and look for work they can do together. And that keeps nature churning. It keeps nature evolving. And now we've satisfied the constructor law in all its detail, that we've taken the very basic system, a very simple principle of conductivity, has constantly recapitulated itself to create this complex structure of social, coherent social behavior. They form a pack, they form a group, and they're out there doing their circuit. And if nobody was there to feed them, and if there was a viable prey population, I believe they would evolve into a very effective hunting group, just like wolves on the tundra. We would see it recapitulate. Now, our modern society isn't going to allow that to happen, and it's there's no free prey out there for them, so we're not likely to see it happen. Right. But I could tell a few stories where it started to happen. I might have mentioned her, but I'll recapitulate one story. I was in the 70s. I was training a Bernese Mountain Dog, and I thought I had him under control. I was using the dominant approach, and I took him into the herd of cattle that my dad had. They were polled Herefords. And to make a very long story short, as soon as that dog was 1 millimeter outside the prescribed training control I had set, he bolted and hit this cow and bit her as hard as he could in the armpit. She couldn't get him off. She couldn't kick him. It was interesting how this dog that lived in a city, basically a city life, knew exactly where to hit an 800-pound cow so he could hang on for half an hour without getting hurt. And anyhow, they went on a Wild West stampede, and finally the cows herded up like a buffalo herd in a circle. And the bull withdrew and started to ram this dog.
Wow.
Finally, I was able to catch up to the group and save the dog. But thereafter, these lazy old, goopy old cows, polled Herefords that my dad just fed them. We didn't do anything with them. They just lazed around. They just moved as an unformed mass. They started to act like a wild buffalo herd.
Wow.
They moved coherently. They also took better care of their young after that.
Wow.
They didn't let the calves wander around like they used to. It was amazing to see the herd transform. So in my own mind, I speculate, well, if that dog could regularly make prey on those cows, if he had a couple buddies that could have, by himself, he couldn't bring the cow down. But if there were a couple other dogs nipping at the heels while he had her really he locked into her front armpit. She couldn't get him off, and he would eventually tire her down. If there are other dogs there to help, I mean, they would have become a functioning herding group, killing group. I have no doubt that they could have done it, but it would have required that kind of neglect on our part to let that happen, you know?
Yeah.
So we're not going to see it, but I believe it's still there in the dog. That information hasn't been lost. It's still there. But there has to be the right charge to bring it back to the surface, the right conditions. But anyhow, we're seeing it in all its ways, and all the little things that dogs do are a slice of that continuum. And if we were to apply the right lens to it, it becomes quite obvious, in my view.
And that sounds like that dog and the stress that it generated in the herd, they resolved it by becoming a more coherent. So that was actually the positive role of stress made the herd more intelligent, more adaptive. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so I think the function of dysfunction is the predator puts pressure on the prey becomes more social, and then the predator has to become more social in response to the prey becoming more social.
Yeah.
I think that's really how sociability evolved, is through that putting pressure, and that forced the prey became more complex, the predator became more complex.
Wow.
And it's not competition.
Evolution right there.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, I think I saw it in West Reading, Connecticut on one Saturday afternoon that went horribly awry from my point of view.
Yeah.
But I was there. I was there with a musk ox and some wild, one wild wolf, let me tell you.
Well, and you know, another thing you mentioned that that decision to resolve or release or to seek relief is influenced by the freedom of that the landscape affords for the animal to move. And and so there's this, and then there's also the emotional capacity, which is like an inner freedom or an inner expanse of space, which also allows the, so that makes me think of caring capacity of the land versus emotional capacity. I mean, those seem like really connected terms, you know, that we use a lot in tracking to think about, you know, how much, you know, what's going to happen in this valley. And now I'm seeing how that connects to the immediate moment and the interactions.
Yeah, the correlation sounds exactly right. Yep.
Wow. So I want to make sure that I understand this correctly. That, and so I'm just going to ask a stupid question. Where is the emotional battery in an animal? Like, where do you find it?
It's in every cell of the body. You know, I wrote an essay on one of my old computers that died. It's in there somewhere. But I wrote this essay speaking of bile and white blood cells and all this stuff, and like electrolytes in a battery. We even say that the body could be acid or alkaline.
Hmm.
What makes our skin protective is it has an acid mantle.
Hmm.
You know, and of course, the neurochemical activity in the heart and the pH of everything, blood. So we are a battery. Hmm. We're electrolyte battery. And my belief is that on the architectural level of the mind, well below consciousness and unconsciousness, I mean, at the frame of the mind, the framework, like an airframe, a plane around an airframe, that is this battery.
Hmm.
Every cell is part of it. It's like a cell in a battery. And I believe the physical, I believe that when we subliminally focus on our center of gravity, which is constantly moving through our body as we move, that it is having an effect on the cells around that area that's occupied by the physical center of gravity in that moment.
Oh, interesting.
And this is giving us a bipolar makeup. And I don't know enough about physiology to go much further than that, but it makes sense to me.
Yeah, what does it mean then for the emotional battery? You say it has two poles, so what does it mean for it to be more negative or more positive? Like, how does that translate?
What exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean, maybe I'm not understanding the concept, but so if the emotional battery acquires a charge, which is stress and physical memory,
Well, for example, look how dogs smell each other.
Mm-hmm.
The front end goes to the hind end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the positive terminal goes to the negative to the positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they immediately stack up like batteries.
Hmm.
Right, they couple like a battery. So the battery is what allows them to couple, to know how to, when they touch the genitals, and they smell and lick the other dog's genitals, they're giving him pleasure. So they're taking, he's uptight, he's worried about this dog that's come into his space.
Mm-hmm.
But if his capacity is high enough, all of a sudden this object of resistance is sensualizing his hind end.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we go from this static electric thing to a current flowing. And when a current flows, it makes a magnetic field. So now we see the two dogs' necks start to act magnetically with each other, and they start to align on a common way of traveling. Or we could say they begin to mirror each other. So mirroring and align and synchronization are the same thing.
Hmm.
And if I had to design organisms that knew how to do that, I'd embed them with this bipolar makeup that creates a current. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about, the release of emotion toward a pure track, that's the current. When a current flows, it'd be like an electrical current. When it flows, it begets a magnetic field. So that would be the purpose of the sexual organs. So the head of the one sensually aroused organism wants to ingest the body of the other, so it gravitates towards the hind end. And then vice versa happens with the other one. He feels pleasure, so now all of a sudden he gravitates toward the body of the other one. So now these two objects of resistance are pleasuring each other. And now you start to go from electric to magnetic to electromagnetic dynamo, where the more they move, the more they arouse each other, the more energy, they turn old stress into resolved emotion. So it's like the energy in the battery now is powering up this dynamo. And their stress reserves that used to make them tentative is now releasing. So, for example, you take a dog out for a walk, and he's picking up all this charge. Now, in a dog owner's mind, and this happens to millions of dog owners, especially puppies, is people out there walking their dog, and they think the dog is losing charge. They think the dog is getting tired and is therefore losing charge.
Right.
But in reality, because the dog is can't give all his energy yet, he's a little unsure, he's building charge. And then he comes back indoors and starts to zoom, zoom, zoom like a maniac around the house. Mm-hmm. That's because he's releasing, he built up all this charge, and it comes out as a surge, and he feels safe with the owner and in the confinement of the house. He's got enough supple where he zoom, zooms around. And he's actually orbiting the handler, the owner,
right,
by bouncing off everything and running every which way. That's a form of this stress coming out as new energy. And what owners have to do just to get to the training end of it is not to let that bounce off the walls, but to collect it, attract it, and make it more coherent, because it's like a fire hose just flying all over the place. We got to capture that energy. We can't let it just do its own thing. But anyhow, it's indicative of this stored charge surging out. So if however, the two dogs can entrain enough, get enough capacity toward each other, then that 400-volt problem, they resolve it by syncopating. And they need now to find a 400 volts of resistance to overcome, which answers the question, is why are our dogs running down the road and chasing cars and biting mailmen, and why are they doing this? My cat doesn't want to run down the neighbors and bark at them, but it's an issue with dogs because they got this charge, and it can only go out the way it went in, and they have to synchronize with objects of resistance in order to turn that old energy into flow, which means they've recapitulated the first principle of conductivity, of emotion being released towards a pure prey attractor.
So
that's what's going on.
So the emotional battery is in every cell of the body.
The whole organism as a whole, the head and the hind are the two poles.
Yeah, but how does that connect to the gut brain? Like, they seem like similar concepts. Is there a relationship, a closer relationship there, or how does that work?
Well, the vagal nerve would be how they connect.
Okay.
If you're asking mechanically or physiologically.
Yeah, well, even like, I mean, I know you've mentioned before that if you grab a dog on their inner thigh, right, which seems close to the gut, you know, close to that, there's like a more visceral primal reaction.
Then you release all the stress. Yeah, the stress accretes around the hind end because that's where the center of gravity and momentum, the force will be gathered in the hind end when it runs, when it pushes off to go forward. And also when a dog's collected, his hind end is a pivot point so he can move in any direction. And so if his weight is on his hind end, then he's very adroit. Conversely, if he's got to run for his life or run after prey, all the force will be generated from the hind end mostly. It's a tremendous power. So his center of gravity and its equivalent force is centered in his hind end. So when he projects his center of gravity into something, mm-hmm. he's disconnected from his hind end.
Hmm. Yeah.
He can only connect with his hind end by connecting to the thing that now possesses his center, his feeling of his center of gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if I've given you enough there to make that leap, but that's how those two poles get disconnected. That's why the battery has two vivid poles. The front end isn't necessarily connected to the hind end,
right,
unless it feels resonance with the surroundings,
mm-hmm.
which brings us back to physical memory being so vivid that the dog doesn't make a distinction between the external and the internal. It's mm-hmm. all one continuous thing in his experience. So when he sees, when something stimulates him, it's only stimulating because it knocked him off balance. His center of gravity was perturbed.
Yeah.
And whatever knocked him off balance now possesses his center of gravity because he's got to neutralize that stimulus in order to return to equilibrium.
Hmm.
So that thing now possesses his center of gravity that he can't achieve wholeness unless he resolves that with that stimulus. So the battery is the best way to make a model for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a charge. You know, a battery runs out; it just dissipates unless you put a charge on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stimulation.
Right, right, You, in explaining some dog behaviors, like you peeing on a fire hydrant or, you know, that kind of thing, you've gone back into their physical memories of infancy and
right.
and then pointed to that as this, they're reliving something from there,
right.
You know, that, so this thing that is common to all dogs, that we think of as instinct is actually a within their lifetime physical memory.
Exactly. Yes.
You know,
exactly right.
And I don't know if I mentioned before, but cougars, I think both dogs and cougars will do this scraping behavior with their hind feet where.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right. And it's funny because the description of cougars when they do it is I've never actually seen it, but I've heard that they get this sort of dreamy look, they're looking into the middle distance, and it's almost like a unconscious or even robotic, you know, hypnotic scraping
right.
of the back feet, you know, and so I wonder, like, what are you pointing at to say why a dog would do that? And I wonder if we can see that also in a cougar, you know?
Yeah, I would speculate that the cougar is reliving the physical memory of his mother cleaning him, because cats have the same. They can't urinate or defecate
mm-hmm.
in the first days of life until the mother licks them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so as the animal's always reliving that early template. So when that cougar, if it lives a solitary life, it would seem, when it's out there wandering and acquiring resistance, that's giving it a social value of its imprint. Those animals, its parents that, or siblings and its parents that imprinted it as an infant. Mm-hmm. It's reliving those experiences, even though it's out there solitary. When it's scratching and doing those things, and you see that dreamy look that you just described,
yeah.
You know, it's reliving that sensuous oneness that it had when it nursed with the mother and she. I can only speak from personal experience with puppies. As you see the mother, the puppy is just trying to stand and get along, and he's just moving a little bit, and the mother runs over, knocks him over, licks him like crazy, and he's like screaming, and what the hell? I mean, he can't even see what knocked him over, what
yeah.
bus ran him over. He's just got knocked over. She's cleaning him, which starts to feel a little better because he relieves himself.
Yeah.
And then she curls up around him because he's screaming, knocking her off balance. So she curls up, and he starts to nurse, and he goes back into dream time and dreamland. He's back into weightlessness. So this is an imprint that I can see so vividly in Dawes. When I got one dog now, when he has to go to the bathroom, he likes to sidle up underneath a bush. And he rubs his back in the bush, and then he starts scratching, and he does. He has this dreamy look, and he's all getting soft, and he can almost like fall over. He kind of loses track. He gets all goopy and almost keels over, and then he comes to his senses and gets on with it. There's this little moment where he goes into a reverie, and that's what's going on. They're reliving physical memories, and we read thoughts into it. Yeah. Well, In my view, it speaks to physical memory is the currency of the network, that it's organizing all these. What physical memory does is make the individual act like an electromagnetically charged particle so that we will respond in a complicated way, a complex way, which is exactly how nature interacts. Right. It's exactly how electromagnetically charged particles interact to form all the living things we see around us.
Right. You know, and just to like as a first possible step. I mean, you've challenged Garth and I several times to do our own thinking on why animals who are not dogs, which is your area of expertise, why other animals might behave in the way they do through the lens of the immediate moment. And I for whatever reason I keep coming back to cougars over and over, and I maybe because they're they're just big cats, so they're like there's a closer connection there, and we already you already tell so many good stories about wolves, and one of the things that I was reflecting on was that there's this overlap in cougar territories, and that's where they tend to leave scat. And to urinate and to make these scrape marks and, on trails and such. And it makes me wonder, it's like, as a possible way of thinking about it, could it be that the cougar experiences another animal's, because of the carrying capacity of the land and a limit of freedom is finally reached and there's another cougar and there's the scat left by the cougar. And that creates an experience of stress, and so a release of stress would be a literal release of bowels of
exactly,
urine,
yeah.
And it's not the intent isn't to mark territory because that is a human thought. The urge is to get release that feels good.
Right, exactly, and it's an indirect way of connecting with that other cougar. It's that feces. And that scrape area is an object of connection. So by reliving the physical memory, the cougar feels connected to that other cougar.
It's almost like a frisbee and a dog, a human with a frisbee.
Yeah.
Maybe, like it's that third, that thing in the middle that allows them.
It's the midpoint. Yeah, all objects are in service to connection. I mean, when an object comes into the mind, it has network parameters built into it, so it serves the network. The mental process of objectification, it's not the individual brain taking data in and then putting it to some sensible organization.
Yeah.
And we say, that's a tree, and trees have these attributes. That's not how it comes to mind in the animal mind, and I dare say the human mind as well. It comes into mind in service to the network so that we see it in a specific way that will organize us in a way that complements what the network needs us to be doing. So, to give you an example, I would go to Las Vegas and they put you into a frame of mind where money doesn't mean money anymore. Or you go to some of the resorts and they I don't know, when I go on vacation, money changes value. All of a sudden, what the heck? You have a timeless thing, and you just spend the money you brought with you. It's not even money after a while.
Right.
Some of the resorts like to change it into some kind of little bead, and you don't even know it's money at this point.
Yeah.
So the network has an influence on how we perceive things. We don't perceive them objectively. Nothing could be sillier, in my way of looking at things, to think that there's any objective measure of reality. Mm-hmm. And I like to say our most objective measure would be our most subjective faculties. Mm-hmm. If we could see the thermodynamics into the way we feel and the way emotion works, we'd be the most objective lens into the nature of reality, mm-hmm. nature of nature. I believe our bodily senses are our most objective metric, even though, of course, they make us the most subjectively polarized. But there is a logic to it, an energetic logic that can grant us a much clearer vision of what we're seeing, and rather than reflexively read thoughts into what animals are doing. But the cougar is indirectly connecting with the other cougar. But they don't have the emotional capacity to connect directly because they're solitary hunters. Mm. And they're meant to be, the network wants them spaced out. Mm-hmm. And I like what Adrian Bijan writes in Design and Nature, and I'm currently going through his new book. Mm-hmm. To refer back to Design and Nature, is yeah. a big impulse is saturation. The medium has to saturate the field. Mm-hmm. So what we call all this, what we see as pressure, is saturation. That the species are spreading out and saturating the environment. That's what's most important. It's like you pour water on a area, and it just spreads out and saturates the area. And that's what we've misidentified as territoriality.
Right.
And even the parents having more offspring than can survive.
Right.
I don't believe in the Darwinian, Malthusian interpretation of that creating grist for the mill. Mm-hmm. I think it creates saturation
right.
to flood the field so that the network can now start its work.
Yeah, it's like blowing air into a balloon and saying the air is being territorial
right.
by filling the whole balloon.
Right.
When it's,
right.
you know, it's this
That's
fundamental pressure.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. 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 So, yeah, that the cougar would—he's attracted to the other cougar, but the charge is beyond their capacity because they're not meant to. They don't. Last thing we need is two cougars cooperating.
Right.
Right. You know, that's the last thing we need. So the network says, "No, that's a little too much. The prey got to live too."
Yeah. Yeah, right. So, you know, I'm thinking that we have at least one more big conversation in us, and that would be on heart, I think. It seems like there's a lot there, and it being the third brain and you know, on
right.
and so kind of makes it all more complicated, but I'm hoping that next time we can touch on, what does it mean for there to be this networked mind and this networked behavior, and to really get deep into things you've been touching on mirroring and syncopation.
Good.
And well, great.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the heart is the electromagnetic dynamo.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
So yeah, that would be a great topic.
Well, great. Yes. So that's, we'll get that next time.
Excellent.
But for now, just for our listeners, I've been talking with Kevin Behan. He's the author of Natural Dog Training and Your Dog is Your Mirror. And he writes a blog at naturaldogtraining.com, along with being an expert dog trainer and training others to in this immediate approach theory. So thanks again, Kevin. And I look forward to talking again soon.
I do as well. Thank you, Will.
All right. Take care.
Indeed. You too. Bye.